It is Tuesday, February 23rd, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, President Obama presents a plan to shut down the U.S. Detention Center for Terrorist Suspects at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, within the coming year. But is it a mission impossible? I'll ask our White House correspondent. A reporter who's recently been monitoring the Syrian conflict from across the Turkish border gives us his assessment of the prospects for a U.S. and Russian-backed ceasefire deal. And we'll hear from a correspondent in Ivory Coast about why the world's top producer of cashew nuts is experiencing a boom. It's all ahead on International Edition. President Obama has sent Congress a long-awaited plan for closing the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, beginning a final push to fulfill a campaign promise and one of his earliest national security goals. I spoke with our White House correspondent Mariela Salinas about that plan a short while ago and asked her why Obama is starting this final push now.
Well, today is the deadline that Congress had for him to put forward this plan. And there have been multiple delays. There's been word for months that the Pentagon was about to release its plan. Obama asked the Pentagon to come up with a plan for how to close Guantanamo Bay so he could present this to Congress. This was very important to this president. It is a promise he made when he came into office, and it was pushed to the very last minute. This report was put together with lots of restrictions, so I think the White House and the Pentagon admit there are a lot of numbers that aren't firm yet, because Congress then went and put some restrictions on how much money they could spend on this report, and there are some laws that made it more difficult for them to put this report together.
Is one of those laws the fact that the president can't actually bring any detainees from Guantanamo to U.S. soil?
Yep. The terrorists cannot be brought to U.S. soil. That's correct. Or that no money can be used by the government to close Guantanamo Bay. So it's just interesting. And this is something during the White House briefing that we had here just a couple of hours ago that is brought up, that Congress asked the Obama administration for a report, and then, according to the White House, then went and put in all these rules that limited what it can do to present this report, and has put all kinds of barriers up to prevent Guantanamo Bay from being closed.
So there's a lot of politics.
Yeah,
does it seem like the White House is being asked to do something impossible by Congress?
That is the view of the White House, exactly. And the Congress has made it clear that it does not believe that the Guantanamo Bay should be closed. So they're at odds about it. This is a Republican-led Congress. This is a Democratic president. And so this is a big issue. This is a big issue between those two parties, and a fundamental difference on how they view terrorism and how to handle it.
And what did the leading Republicans in Congress say today in response to Obama's plan?
That it makes no sense, that it is doesn't provide critical details required by law, which I think the White House says is true. They could come up with sort of an estimate on how much some of this would cost, but because they were limited in their research, because Congress limited how much the money the White House could spend on coming up with this report, it couldn't provide all the details. So Republicans say it's against the law, it'll stay against the law, to transfer terrorist detainees to American soil. So it seems like it's going nowhere fast, but the White House position is it's an opportunity. Congress can act. The White House says it's against our national security interests to keep Guantanamo Bay open. And it costs a lot of money unnecessarily. The White House contends this is something we can do with our own prison system, or we can transfer many of these detainees to other countries.
Okay, well, thank you so much to our White House correspondent, Mariela Salinas, for that update.
You're welcome, Michael.
All right, well, up next, we have International Edition's G. Abby Lee in the studio to bring us the social media side of things. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
Well, you know, the Guantanamo Bay facility has been a controversial issue for a long time now, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So in general, the Democrats are open to the idea, whereas the Republicans are against it. And the White House's Twitter account quoted President Obama's announcement, and it reads like this. It's been clear that the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not advance our national security. It undermines it. So to that tweet, one user wrote, President, your values are not my values. War criminals should be punished. Unborn babies should be given a second chance at life. So I just want to quickly mention that that reply implies closing down the facility means freeing all those incarcerated there, but that will not be the case.
Right. Well, I noticed the White House live account was also tweeting this announcement. What did you see there?
So that's the account that live tweets president's announcements and also White House events. And its handle is at WH Live, as you know. And one of the tweets reads, it drains military resources, that which means keeping it going, with nearly $450 million spent last year to keep it running. So to that, one person argued, how much money do we spend on welfare, trying to compare those two expenses? Now, moving on to media, the Capital Journal tweeted, Obama's plan would transfer Guantanamo detainees to a facility in the U.S., and it asked for $475 million in construction costs. To that, one Twitter user wrote, more spending, shaking my head. Yet another user wondered, why not just put them in solitary confinement in an existing Supermax prison for free?
It may not quite be free, huh?
No, not really. And to explain what Supermax is, it's short for Super Maximum Security, and it describes control unit prisons for the worst offenders.
Okay, well, before you go, what are some of the hashtags that people can search to read up on this issue?
Gitmo is a popular one, but so is Guantanamo at
right.
the moment.
And Gitmo is kind of a slang for Guantanamo. It's spelled G-I-T-M-O, in case you're wondering. Well, thank you so much, G. You can follow her on Twitter. Her handle is at G Abby Lee. And I'm there, too, at Michael_Lippin. And, of course, please follow our program's Twitter account. It is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Could a visit with your doctor be just down the hall? In France, doctors can make virtual home visits over the internet. The patient enters a consultation station, also called an e-booth, and manipulates diagnostic tools at the prompting of the doctor. Vincent Hillenmeyer is with H4D, the company that makes the e-booth.
H4D manufactures the consult station, which is a telemedicine kiosk, which replicates the environment and the equipment of a doctor's office.
Doctors can get basic information from their patients in the booth.
There's a stethoscope. There's also a tool called the otoscope. It's for ENT examinations, ear, throat, and nose.
Doctors say the e-booth can save significant travel time for them and their patients in rural areas, allowing physicians to have more time to see more people. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he is uncertain about whether a joint U.S.-Russia-backed ceasefire set to take effect in Syria on Saturday will actually work or lead to a negotiated peace settlement of the Syrian conflict. That deal also faces many doubts among rebels fighting the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Correspondent Jamie Detmer was recently monitoring the conflict on the Turkish side of the Turkish-Syrian border. He's now in Rome, and my colleague Susan Yaki asked him today what he learned about the attitudes of the rebels toward the truce agreement.
Well, it's been pretty consistent amongst the rebel commanders anyway, and really within the Syrian opposition, the political opposition, of a great deal of skepticism about this. For them, one of the key problems with the cessation proposal is this non-inclusion of Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate, and possibly other groups. I mean, it's meant to be those groups defined by the UN as terrorists. But as we've seen, really, with the Damascus administration and with the Kremlin and Moscow, they're pretty wide about how they define terrorists. It's, you know, quite frequently anyone who is opposed to President Bashar al-Assad. One of the drawbacks for them is this, that they believe that the regime with Russian backing is wanting to swing the offensive now that it is completed a lot of its operations in northern Aleppo to a neighboring province, Idlib, where Jabhat al-Nusra and some other groups are really focused and have a stronghold there. And the theory is that they want to then close the border crossing that comes into Idlib from Turkey, which would mean then all supply routes from Turkey would basically have been cut by the regime in this blistering offensive of the last 2 weeks. And so they see this non-inclusion of Jabhat al-Nusra as a pretext, really, for carrying on with an offensive, but having the stamp of approval of Western nations, because Jabhat al-Nusra has been written out of this cessation of hostilities.
A previous proposed ceasefire did not work out. Do you think this time it may come into effect, may be followed?
Well, I mean, to be perfectly frank, amongst commanders, amongst Syrian political opposition I speak to privately, amongst European diplomats, amongst refugees themselves, there really is a great deal of scepticism whether this cessation will come off. There are quite a lot of other problems with it. You mentioned some of the demands of the Syrian political opposition. You left one out, and that is that there's meant to be the releasing of political detainees by the Assad regime, and that seems unlikely that they will do it. I think that there are lots of wiggle room on all sides to cause problems with this cessation. There's another one as well. One of the reasons they're using the term cessation of hostilities legally rather than ceasefire is this whole question: if you have a ceasefire, there's a legal framework, there's enforcement and monitoring. And as the UN admitted a month ago, they don't have the ability to really monitor abuses of the cessation.
Is anybody making any suggestions other than this ceasefire or cessation of hostilities?
The general idea of a political solution, but you know, a political deal, as far as Assad's opponents are concerned, is that he must go. It's the bottom line for them, that he can play no part in a political transition, for example. And then, of course, the position of Damascus and Moscow is that Assad shouldn't necessarily have to go. I mean, certainly in Damascus, the Assad regime thinks that he should be staying. There has been some suggestion that maybe Moscow down the road will be prepared to back the idea of Assad going, as long as he's replaced with someone who's acceptable to Moscow.
Well, and that was our correspondent, Jamie Detmer, speaking with International Edition's Susan Yaki. Ivory Coast is cashing in on cashew nuts. Over the past 10 years, the country has increased its cashew production by 400% and recently overtook India as the world's top cashew nut producer. But the cashew farmers in Ivory Coast remain challenged by domestic problems, as we hear from Emily Ayab in Abidjan.
The harvest has just started, but the mood is good among cashew farmers in Ivory Coast. This year again, the government announced an increase in the minimum selling prices. Raymond Kouakou, a former real estate agent, started planting cashew trees in his home village back in 1999.
My friend told me that cashew production could put food on the table. He encouraged me to start.
But the development of the budding industry was put on hold until 2011 as the West African nation entered multiple political crises. Now the sector is growing again thanks to increasing global demand. National production almost doubled in the last 5 years alone to reach 25% of the global output, making Ivory Coast the world's top producer ahead of India and Vietnam. The government played a major role in developing and regulating the sector by setting control and minimum prices through the same group that also regulates cotton production. Producer and buyer Aruna Konate says it helped a lot.
Borders were very porous. Our product would go to the neighboring countries. And there were also a lot of speculation because we didn't really know what was the global market price for cashew. But now, thanks to Cotton Cashew Council, it's all right.
However, Ivory Coast only processes about 6% of its total cashew production. The nuts are sent to Asia to be processed, then sold to consumers in the U.S. and in Europe. For Cotton Cashew Council Director Malamin Sanogo, increasing domestic processing is the next key step to developing the industry.
We believe that if we domestically process the cashew, we should be able to increase the farm gate prices by 80% if I compare to other countries.
Sanogo says the Ivorian government plans to domestically process all of its cashew production by 2020. Emilia Yap for VOA News in Abidjan.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, Give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. The American company now known as Alcoa was the first to commercialize aluminum production more than 100 years ago. That industry eventually employed tens of thousands of workers around the United States. But aluminum smelting is now in steep decline domestically. As correspondent Tom Bonsi reports, tough competition from China and other nations is hurting this traditional American manufacturing sector.
Smelter worker Chris Morales of Wenatchee, Washington, remembers the day he learned he was being laid off via a text on a day off.
You know, it's a feeling of surprise, panic, now what? You know, my wife's got a good job. I'm fortunate for that. But still, I was counting on Alcoa that's been around for years.
64 years here in Wenatchee, in fact. And while Alcoa insists it still will make aluminum in the Pacific Northwest, many laid-off workers have doubts.
The advice was something along the lines of, you need to go find another job.
Morales is moving on, hoping service as a volunteer firefighter will turn into a career position. The idling of the Alcoa Wenatchee smelter at the beginning of January cost around 420 jobs, which paid around double the average wage of that area. Another 465 workers at another Alcoa smelter outside Ferndale, Washington, are worried too. Barry Hullett is the plant manager there.
It is important to notice the difference between a curtailment and a closure. When we curtail a plant, we keep it in operating condition so it may be restarted. That's different than a closure.
Hullett told state senators that what the remaining Pacific Northwest smelters face is indefinite curtailment. Hullett hopes market conditions will change for the better. The price for aluminum fell around 30% last year.
The metal price shouldn't stay at this level. It's at historic lows. And so commodity cycle should change. And hopefully when that does, we'll be positioned to keep operations going in Washington State.
15 years ago, there were 23 active aluminum smelters in the U.S. Today, there are only 6, including that one in Ferndale. And by mid-year, there could be fewer after scheduled closures. Karen McBeth follows aluminum's fortunes for the industry news service Platts. She says U.S. firms face tough competition from newer smelters in China and other countries.
It's interesting how China has just completely overtaken the industry, and it's true of a lot of metals markets, not just aluminum, but they now account for about half of global production and half of global demand, so they're a huge factor.
McBeth says she's rooting for a U.S. comeback, but not counting on it.
At the moment, though, a number of these smelters are actually getting dismantled, so it's going to be a little late, for the U.S. industry to try to make that comeback if the price doesn't improve soon.
McBeth says aluminum production is very energy intensive, so any revival might also require favorable power deals. New York State just reached a subsidy deal to keep the Northeast's only remaining smelter in operation for 3 more years. Back in Washington State, longtime smelter worker Kelly Woodard says losing metal production hurts U.S. strategic interests.
I guess I'm not a big fan of government supplying a lot of money to corporations, but I as a citizen, think it's vital to keep some type of aluminum production in the U.S., and I'm hoping a lot that the Northwest can maybe, keep a couple smelters around.
The Chicago-based Century Aluminum Company and the United Steelworkers Union are lobbying for trade sanctions against Chinese aluminum exports. The U.S. Labor Department agreed American aluminum industry workers have been harmed by foreign trade when it approved special retraining and dislocated worker benefits recently. For VOA News, I'm Tom Botsey in Wenatchee, Washington.
Now for a look at the world of entertainment. The Berlin Film Festival is known for showcasing stories that serve as commentaries on political and social issues. One such commentary featured in this year's Berlin Festival is Road to Istanbul, a film about a European mother's journey to try to rescue her daughter who goes to Syria to join the Islamic State militant group. VOA's Faiza El-Masri tells us more about the film in this report narrated by Faith Lapidus.
Elizabeth is a single mother living in the Belgian countryside with her 18-year-old daughter, Elodie. Life suddenly changes one weekend when Elodie fails to come home, and Elizabeth discovers she's gone off with her new boyfriend to try to join the Islamic State in Syria. Elizabeth reaches out to the authorities for help, but since Elodie is an adult and decided to go of her own free will, they say there's nothing they can do to help. So Elizabeth, portrayed by Belgian actress Astrid Wetnall, decides to find her daughter herself.
It's interesting to have the chance to get to know those kind of shadow side and those fears, to respect all the mothers who live those kind of things. And she's so brave. She's so powerful. She's so honest. So it was really wonderful to have this kind of character to play.
Road to Istanbul is the latest work from French-born Algerian filmmaker Rachid Boucharab.
I didn't choose someone of Muslim origin and culture. I took someone who had nothing to do with that world, nothing to do with the Arab world, nothing to do with that culture. And it's that which interested me, how a young 18-year-old Belgian girl is going to move towards a conversion, to convert and go to Syria. I took that example.
The film, shot in Belgium and Algeria, is based on real events, although the characters are not real.
It's not just one story. I would say that it's a set of testimonies from mothers and fathers in a formation that I could group together and on which I built this story. I can't say this girl exists from the beginning to the end.
The filmmaker hopes Road to Istanbul will help raise awareness and discussion about why young people want to head off to jihad. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Dan Crafton. My thanks to both of them. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Please reach out to me on Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. My handle is @Michael_Lippin. And, of course, this show is there, too, @VOA_IE. Thanks so much for listening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Freedom of religion, a right upheld in the United States Constitution, is a tenet that Americans hold dear. President Barack Obama recently reaffirmed this right for all Americans and emphasized the importance of pluralism in American society during his first presidential visit to a U.S. mosque. When enshrining freedom of religion in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, our founders meant what they said when they said it applied to all religions. The president noted that Islam has always been a part of America. Generations of Muslim Americans helped to build our nation. They were part of the flow of immigrants who became farmers and merchants. They built America's first mosque. The first Islamic center in New York City was built in the 1890s. Muslim Americans worked on Henry Ford's assembly line, cranking out cars. A Muslim American designed the skyscrapers of Chicago, said President Obama. He also highlighted the many contributions the Muslim American community are making in American society. Muslim Americans enrich our lives today in every way. They are our neighbors, the teachers who inspire our children, the doctors who we entrust with our health. They're scientists who win Nobel Prizes, young entrepreneurs who are creating new technologies that we use all the time. They're the sports heroes we cheer for. At a time when others are trying to divide us along lines of religion or sect, he said, we have to reaffirm that most fundamental of truths. We are all God's children. We're all born equal with inherent dignity. President Obama noted the importance of staying true to American core values, including religious freedom for all faiths, and acknowledged that at times the U.S. has fallen short of those ideals. He warned against the dangers of discrimination, bigotry, and a lack of protection for all faiths within society. Groups like ISIL are desperate for legitimacy, said President Obama. The best way for us to fight terrorism is to deny these organizations legitimacy and to show that here in the United States of America, we do not suppress Islam. We celebrate and lift up the success of Muslim Americans. That's how we show the lie that they're trying to propagate.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.